Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is June 28th, 2004. Today's session number is POM 2004-01. Today's speaker is Michael Pullett. And the lesson for today is Summoned Out to be Human, Called or Collared. Let's listen in.
Sessions this week on the theme Summoned Out What We Shall Be. And I'm taking a very broad look at this. I'm asking the question, what does it mean to be human? To be summoned out as a human being. And today I want to focus on the notion of summoning itself and look at three pictures. One are three paintings. One, a Renaissance painting. This is The Calling of St. Matthew by Caravaggio. And we'll spend most of our time on this. And then looking at two postmodern paintings painted in the 70s by two artists. And again, dealing with this notion of summoning or calling. And the interesting thing about this, I think, first of all, is the challenge in art, because summoning or calling is an auditory thing, right? You hear a call, you hear a summons. And so now the artist has the challenge, how do you paint? How do you see a calling? And so what we're going to do is read some of these paintings to see how we hear a calling. And so we'll start with the one here by Caravaggio. It's The Calling of St. Matthew. A little background on Caravaggio. Caravaggio is an Italian Renaissance painter. His name is Michelangelo Merisi, and he was named after Michelangelo the Great Painter. His dates are 1571 to 1610. And The Calling of St. Matthew, the picture we have here, was painted right around 1600. He's called Caravaggio because that's the name of the community in Italy where he is from. It's a small farming community just a little east of Milan. So if you're all familiar with Italy in the Milan area, this is where Caravaggio is from. And Caravaggio is always considered a most controversial painter, because although his paintings, many of which are biblical paintings and paintings of the church and for the church, he always gave what was considered to be a most unorthodox interpretation of all these. So he was always almost kind of a heretic painter, always in trouble for what he did. And of course, this Calling of St. Matthew is also one that puts him into trouble, because it too does not particularly give the kind of pristine, pure, holy calling that a saint or apostle deserves. And we will take a look at that. Again, the text for The Calling of St. Matthew is just one verse. It's from Matthew chapter 9, verse 9. Jesus saw a man called Matthew at his seat in the custom house and said to him, "Follow me." And Matthew rose and followed him. That's it. That's all we have about the calling of Matthew. And so from that single verse, Caravaggio gives us this understanding about the calling of St. Matthew. And so first of all, as we look at this painting, we'll try to figure out if we can see the main characters in that. First of all, where's Matthew?
Far left.
Where do you think Matthew is? Here?
No.
No.
Far left with his head down?
This guy?
No. One farther down.
This one?
That's him? Yeah. Like him. He's counting money.
Yeah. No, that's not Matthew. It is kind of like, where's Waldo?
Yeah.
One to his chest.
The one to the left of the beard.
The beard.
Oh,
in the middle.
This? You think this is Matthew?
Yep.
Yes. This is Matthew. Pointing to himself. And it's not really clear with this, but this is also Matthew's hand. Still on the money. We'll talk about that. Where's Jesus? Where do you think? Sure. This picture here?
Yeah.
This person?
Yeah.
Yes, that's Jesus. And there's one other identifiable character in this picture. It's this person here. Any guesses who this might be?
Peter.
What about, who's counting, the person counting the money, would that be Judas?
No, these would just simply be Matthew's friends or whatever. The three key characters are Matthew, Jesus, and of course Peter, and Peter is the symbol of what?
The church.
Right. So again, already note we've got this kind of tag team going on about how Jesus and the church calls. Maybe. Right. The next thing that's interesting in this painting is, all of you artistic folks, what about the light? What seems to be unusual about the light in this painting? And just speak right up.
Well, it's coming from behind Jesus and up, and Caravaggio loves light and shadow, so he's putting it right on Matthew's face.
Right.
But Jesus still has light on him, from below, almost. It's not clear where that light is.
Yeah, it's like
from.
There's a door open that where there's a lot of light coming through.
Yeah.
And maybe it's early morning because the sun is low in the sky.
Could be, but the kind of interesting thing is there's no light coming in through the window.
No.
You would anticipate if you would think in our typical real world, light would come in through the window.
But it looks like they're blackened.
Huh?
It looks like they're blackened.
They might be blackened. And yet there's a shutter there, a kind of shutter you can see, and trying to give the sense that it's open. But the key here is there's kind of two sources of light, one from behind and one from below, which seem to illuminate Christ and Peter, the church, but also this one from behind that catches what on Jesus?
His finger.
This hand. And then, of course, shines right in to the focal point of Matthew.
But you know, when I look at this, at least in this context, the focal point is not Matthew, it's a boy to Matthew's left. I'm going, geez, that's a really young Matthew. I mean, because that's where all the light seems to, that's what it seems to be illuminated there.
I mean, his face is more illuminated than Matthew's. Of course, Matthew has a beard.
Perhaps. I mean, I don't disagree with
you. No, that's right. I mean,
this isn't a theater spotlight.
Right.
This is not a theater spotlight that can focus solely on Matthew. And Caravaggio loves these boys. And many of his paintings he has.
Right.
These Renaissance boys.
These Renaissance boys that are in that. So that light again, but the sense there, it's a source from the outside that illuminates, and again, what it is meant to illuminate is not any particular person, if you will, but the call, the calling, the action of the calling itself. Another thing, in terms of some of the detail, and again, it doesn't show quite as clearly here as we might like, but I want you to pay attention to the feet, because feet are also important in calling. Let's let's start over here with this little young boy's, not little, but young boy's, young man's feet. What would you want to say about those feet?
They're small.
They're small.
They're off the floor.
Awfully.
Aren't they off the floor? He's sitting on a bench. And
one of them is.
One of them is off the floor.
Yeah.
Looks like he has slippers.
Slippers. Yeah.
Looks like he's getting
ready to go.
Looks like he's getting ready to go. Perhaps maybe, you know, sitting up at attention, a bit startled, surprised.
He has a sword.
He has a sword. That's
right.
Is he
looking right? Is his attention on Peter?
That's cool.
Well, that's a good that's a good question. Exactly, at what is this boy looking at?
It seems like there's a connection between his eye and Peter's. If that's Peter's hand,
right.
It's Jesus' hand and Peter's
hand. This is Peter's hand. This is Jesus' hand.
Is there a distinction between two? Are they the same message or are they different messages?
Yeah, we'll talk about the hands because that's a very good question as well. What about Matthew's feet? It's a little harder to see, but maybe at the legs and everything as well as just the feet. I don't think the light will make a whole lot of difference, Dorothy, but we can try.
It makes a big difference.
It does, okay. Anything you want to say about Matthew's feet?
He's got good, strong legs.
Good, strong legs. Got a lot of hiking.
Like the church.
It looks like his slipper's coming off his left foot.
Yeah, it might be. It might be that he's almost kind of shocked right out of his shoes.
Kind of the angle of his legs looks like he's almost bracing himself
to get up,
trying to back away.
Yeah, that's right. It's, you know, he's... Let's look at these feet. This is Jesus' foot. This is Peter's foot.
Barefoot.
Barefoot.
How beautiful grounded. Are the feet of the messenger.
There's that sense, the feet of the messenger.
They seem to be grounded.
They seem to be grounded, right? As a, you know, these feet always seem to be perhaps a little up in the air or ready to move, and these feet are, if you will, firmly grounded. As you've noted, they're bare feet.
Jesus' feet look like they're pointing out of the room already. He's already leaving. He's not facing them.
Yes. Yes, that's the other thing. It looks like Jesus is in the call, but like he's ready to call and leave, where Peter's feet are positioned such that he's ready to enter. So perhaps in this whole calling, Jesus calls and is ready to go. Peter, in echoing Jesus or whatever, is ready to come in, to stay. Perhaps
Peter
again.
Peter's got a walking stick.
Huh?
Peter's got a walking stick.
Peter has a walking stick, yeah. Again, and that staff or walking stick is in Matthew's gospel, the only thing they were allowed to take with them on their ministry. Other than that, no money, nothing else, but you could take your staff because you got to go.
Peter looks like he's, you know, he's dressed for a journey. He's wearing a coat. The others are in Renaissance. I can't tell exactly what Jesus is wearing. The others are in Renaissance.
Very good. That's the other thing. When you look at the style of clothing, if you will, all of these folks are contemporary Renaissance. Well, in other words, these are the fashion plates of the time. Right, they're dressed up what any hip with it guy in the 1600s would be wearing, and Jesus and Peter are wearing the clothes of antiquity. So that perhaps in one respect, back to this youth's gaze, he could be looking at these folks and saying, "Who are those old weird fuddy-duddies?" Right? Because in terms of clothing, Jesus and Peter are totally out of place. They're not with the times. They're not where it's at, where it's happening. They've missed it. And so there's that sense there that perhaps as we look at the feet and at the style and all of that, we've missed, we can see that there is something old that comes into, or what one might seem as old, that comes into the modern or the present. Okay, next, let's look at the hands. And we'll look first at this hand of Matthew. With that gesture, what? How do you read that? What's Matthew saying?
Who, me?
Who, me?
It almost looks like the finger is pointing back away from him, though. Is it kind of like, could it be, are you talking to me or him?
Yeah, that's right. I think the who, me, are you talking to me? That whole kind of thing, so that there's that that whole gesture, the sense of a call, is first and foremost a question. You know, there must be a mistake here. It couldn't be me. Who? Me? The other thing, of course, like I said, the irony is, as you look at his other hand here, what's in his other hand? The money. And as you look at it, he's gesturing who, me, with his left hand. His right hand is holding the money. And traditionally speaking, this is always the prejudice to all you left-handers, all you lefties in the room. We all know that the right hand is the most important hand. And the things that are really important to you, you clutch in your right hand. So what is Matthew still holding on to?
Money.
Well, show me the money. Right? That sense that, and again, this is of course what gets Caravaggio in trouble and everything, because of course Matthew isn't supposed to be grasping this money in terms of the Orthodox tradition. I mean, he should be throwing it away or something, but no way. The call is coming to him, and yet primarily his attachment is to his money, his possessions. The kind of understanding that we have too, in terms of saying for us as Christians in our modern era, probably what is the greatest obstacle to North American Christianity, at least in terms of calling, our possessions, our wealth. It prohibits and prevents us from heeding the call. But I will contend that that really hasn't changed. Caravaggio notes that. And again, think about this, right? The year 1600, again, height of medieval papacy, height of things like simony, where if you wanted to be a bishop, you could just buy a bishopric. So like sure, how much did Chuck pay for being bishop? Right? No, right, we don't do that anymore. But back then, for $2-3 million, you could be the bishop of Southeast Minnesota, right? what a deal. And of course, the way you would pay that off would be you'd send somebody like Tetzel out to sell indulgences in the territory. I mean, that takes us back to Luther and the Reformation as well. So in the high Middle Ages, the Renaissance, materialism too was that obstacle to calling. And of course, think about Jesus in the Gospels and how often the problem of money is there. Or our first lesson for this Sunday, last night, the calling of Elijah. I mean, what did Elijah, or Elisha, what did Elisha do once Elijah placed the mantle on him? Do you remember?
He slaughtered the ox.
He slaughtered his oxen and what?
He fed it to the people.
He fed it to the people, so he cooked them, and what did he use as wood to cook the oxen?
The little cart.
The yoke, his plow. So in other words, all of his possessions, his means of livelihood, his plow, his cart, his oxen, if you will, Elisha liquidated his assets. Right? No,
and,
right?
And burned his bridges.
Liquidated his assets.
And burned his bridges.
And burned his bridges, fed the people, and heeded the call. And,
Michael,
and same here, I think.
Do you remember who the patron is for this? This?
No, I don't. I don't remember who the patron is for this particular thing. But that sense again of how close money is, and we see it again a little. Look at this person here in the picture. How close, how attentive he is to the money. Right? I mean, he doesn't know what else is going on. He sees no call. Right? Totally oblivious.
He's going
to
take off.
Everything else.
Huh? He's probably going to take over after Matthew.
He may take over after Matthew. And this person as well, again, it doesn't come through here quite as clearly. This person is wearing glasses. And the symbolism of glasses, again, back then, the science of optics and everything like that, one would read glasses because it could only correct short-sightedness. So that, you know, again, if you needed glasses, it shows you were very short-sighted. And if you are short-sighted and your short-sightedness looks at money, it was a symbol that you were a miser. So I'm taking off my glasses. Right. So that this man with his glasses looking at the money is miserly. And of course, he's not paying any attention to the call either. He has no clue what's going on in the room because his focus is right down here. And you note as well, as that light comes in, there still seems to be some light on this as well. So you know, the money, material, prosperity, wealth is always juxtaposed to this sense of call. Look at the hand of Jesus. What does that hand remind you of?
Michelangelo.
And what hand in Michelangelo?
Sistine Chapel.
Adam.
All right. We have the censure. Is it God's hand or Adam's?
God's hand.
God's hand was like looking full of energy when it was coming down, right? That's what I
would like. Anyone else?
Hand
looked like it has a lot of energy.
It's
Adam.
What does God's hand look like?
It could be, but if you look at this, and again, you know, if you look at the books of Caravaggio and all that, and commentaries, this is exactly the duplicate of Adam's hand. Now, okay, you would say, well, gee, shouldn't you? And again, right, this gets Caravaggio into trouble, because, you know, Jesus is God, so, you know, it should have been God, but it's Adam's hand. Why would Jesus have Adam's hand?
He's the new Adam.
Jesus is the new Adam. Why else? In terms of calling, why would Jesus call with Adam's hand, or point with Adam's hand, rather than with God's hand.
Are we connecting this to the curse that you shall labor, etc.?
No, I don't think it's connected to a curse.
A human to a human?
But it's a human to a human because, if you will, Jesus himself is called. Jesus is the sent one, or in that sense, the first called out one, the one who is called to call others. And so there's that sense of passing on that calling. And again, it's always God in that sense of perhaps, if you will, the light coming from behind. It is God who is the light or the illuminator of the call. But the call is always from human to human. In this case, though, it's a very special human. It is the new Adam, the one who totally, fully, completely expresses what it is to be truly human. All right, if you will, God tried to get someone to be truly human in Genesis 1 and 2 with Adam, Adam, the man, but that didn't quite work out so well the first time, so we try it with the second Adam, the new Adam, which is who Christ is. So I think that's what Caravaggio is doing there. And the last hand that I want to look at, Peter's hand and that gesture. What do you think Peter is saying with that gesture? If you will, if there's a dialogue between Matthew and Peter in terms of hands, what's that dialogue?
Yes, you.
Matthew says, who, me? Peter says, yes, you. Or Matthew says, who, me? And Peter says,
you better change.
No. Well, no, I think it's worse than that.
Someone else?
No, at least the way I look at it, probably is more illustrative of my sick mind. Peter is going, who? Him? Well, doesn't that make sense?
Yeah.
This guy's a tax collector.
Yes.
Right?
Are you sure?
He's not going to pass any of the tests that get you in for, you know, your accreditation committees to see whether or not you're fit to be a pastor or fit to be part of God's church. I mean, Matthew's going to flunk out on that. I mean, because look at where that hand's still.
It would be helpful if we were able to see a little bit better Peter's expression. I don't know if it's just the artifact of this, you know, the projection, or could you actually see? Because you really can't make out what his expression is.
Yes, that's intentional. In the painting itself, Peter's back is to us. You don't see his face. That's why I'm saying, you could say, Peter's saying, yes, you, or he could be saying, who, him? I think both of them are totally legitimate interpretations of it. Because I think there again, Caravaggio is specifically saying, yeah, we're not going to see the... You tell me what expression is on his face.
But his hand has an expression, because Jesus is kind of lilting downwards, and his finger could suggest a question because it's kind of lilting upwards. And it's not pointing, it's more, it's still kind of passive. Oh.
And it seems to me that Jesus' hand is determinative. And Peter's probing that call, but it's Jesus who's doing the pointing.
Yes.
Jesus is doing something.
Okay. So then how do you understand Peter's hand? Oh. As questioning, is it a who him or a yes you? That's okay, Lord. You can leave it there.
Oh, it was just a screensaver.
Okay.
There,
we can move on to the next one. This is simply a few of the close-ups here where you can see the hand. You see, there's Matthew's hand still grasping the money. Here's the hunched-over guy. Look at that intensity. You know, show me the money. And here you get, here you can see the glasses on the other, right? The short-sighted person who can only see very, very close up what's in front of him, and of course what's in front of him is the money. That's the whole focal point of everything that's there. Go on to the next one. Here's again the close-up of these folks, what they're looking at, and the question is, and we've talked about that a little bit, if you remember the whole painting, what do you think they're looking at? Are they looking at Peter? Are they looking at Jesus? The gesture? Both? Are these facial expressions of surprise, curiosity, disdain? How do you interpret those glances?
Kind of puzzlement.
Puzzlement?
Well, the one is leaning in on the right, is leaning in kind of in.
Yeah, I'll talk about that. Well, this guy is leaning on Matthew's shoulder.
He's kind of drawn back, but the other one seems more interested.
All right, so again, that's right. If you note one is with these two, this person seems to be veering back a little from everything. This other one is leaning into it. So again, two ways in which we understand and the way in which a summons may come. You might be taken aback by it a little, or you might really lean into it.
Is there any significance to the sword? It's backlit, so it's actually made prominent.
Right.
Is there something about a hand reaching to a sword to
The thing there is to say, well, you know, you got these two guys from the past who just walked into your room. I mean, they're like intruders. You might need to, you know, reach for your sword, reach for your guns, we'd say today, and perhaps that right, this might be the gesture of defense.
Is the defense not just strangers, but that is the defense against the message?
Right.
It looks like that kid looks like he's saying, Matthew, take out the back door, I'll cover it.
But perhaps it also like when you get off a chair with the sword, that sword can't be dangling, you need to
control it.
Need to control it, that's right. I mean, it's as though this person were startled, right? He's just starting to reach for his sword. We don't quite know yet what he's going to do, right? In that sense, again, Caravaggio cuts off the action before it's fully carried through. So it's up to us as we read this painting to interpret what the final action or reaction of this person will be. And of course, what that does, as any interpretation does, is tell us as much about ourselves and the way we react or would react and understand a call.
These guys are the center of the painting too, aren't they?
Yes, in terms of...
Most light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The one on the left is innocent. Yeah.
What, you think this one is innocent?
No, I don't think so.
No.
He's passive skepticism.
I don't think he's innocent.
It's almost like a father-son, those two. Father on the right.
That's right. I mean, the kind of thing, he's here, he's leaning on Matthew's shoulder. I mean, is, you know, one way of looking at that, is this a picture of Matthew and son tax collectors? But we have no idea, you know. Was Matthew married, had a family, did he have kids? When the call comes, what do you do when the call comes and your kids are leaning on your shoulders, your kids are leaning on you for support? You just, you know, again, this guy's leaning on Matthew, what happens if Matthew would get up? The guy collapses.
Michael, could you talk a little bit about these custom houses? I mean, we know that tax collectors were a little snaky. They would keep some of the money for themselves. They had a certain amount they probably had to give to the Romans. What went on around that table? I mean, were these several tax collectors getting together, deciding how the money was going to be divided up?
It almost looks like it's a little bit shady.
That looks like a ledger on the table.
There's a ledger on the table and counting out, but you're right, Bob. Exactly that. The Romans had folks do, if you will, do the dirty work for them. You could contract a whole new way of privatization. You would privatize tax collecting. And what the Romans were concerned about is getting a set amount. Now, if in getting that set amount, you also overcharged and took in twice as much, they didn't care. Let's say the taxes were a dollar. The Romans wanted their dollar. But if I tax you and could get $5 out of you, that's great. There's $4 for me. The Romans didn't care about that. And so that's where all the shady dealing goes on.
But Caravaggio isn't aware of any of that. He has no sense of what was going on in the first century.
Well, I don't know. I think he has some sense. Because that whole tax collective system is still going on at his time. Right?
Or you could say to the same extent that it's going on in our time.
Although, you know, I don't think the IRS is quite as shady as the tax collecting is back then, but I could be wrong.
He knows that tax collectors are despised individuals.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that's about all he knows.
That's certainly the key.
In the Bible, it implies they're dishonest.
Right. Right. The dishonesty is I think, implied in all of that. And again, you see that in somewhat, again, the miser with his glasses and everything, the way that he's characterized there. But, okay, let's move on. Next one again. To give you the whole, well, back one more. To give you yet the whole picture here, as you see this calling of St. Matthew now, what do you think calling entails? Now that we've looked at all of these specific features and everything like that, what's your understanding of a summons? What's your understanding of a call?
It's a surprise.
It's a surprise?
It's unexpected.
Unexpected?
From a strangers or aliens or not like from other planets, but somebody who's just not part of your world.
Yeah, it seems to like it comes from someone or something that's totally out of place. Doesn't fit.
It's urgent, there's no time to think.
Yeah, it's right that it's in your face.
What I think Caravaggio does so wonderfully is that each, with the exception of Peter, there's an expression on each person's face. So the summons is directed to Matthew, but each person also has a kind of response to, in a sense, overseeing, overhearing that summons. And
right.
You can study that.
Right. It's contrary to the system, to the social norm.
Right.
And all those guys are...
And it demands a response.
It demands a response. This is what I think is so interesting. It demands a response, even if the response is not responding at all. Right? I mean, this guy is so focused, doesn't seem like he's aware of any of this stuff happening. But still, that's a response, isn't it? Right? In other words, the calling entails everyone and everything, even if that person doesn't seem to be a part of it from what we would say in terms of our own kind of, like, let's call it decision theology. The other thing about this is there seem, you know, this again also helps us understand, I think, the sense of calling as gift, or as you called it, a surprise. Because unless something other would have entered this room, would have entered this scene, none of this would have happened. And whether one responds toward Christ, Peter, or doesn't even know it, it is a response to the call.
Does it take community for if you get a call that the people around him help him kind of, they're inquisitive also.
Yeah.
I mean, they're...
Yeah, there's also, I don't know if it, if one would want to call this community,
no, but,
there is a sense of the publicness of a call goes on in public, I think, not just simply private.
And maybe, I don't know, it doesn't look like these would support him, but you need someone else to say it's a call or
yeah.
whatever, to say that's your calling.
Well, we probably spend more of our lives than we like being this person who's focused totally on the coins.
Yeah.
We don't even see the call. Yeah. It's not that we see it and reject it. We don't even see it.
Right.
And we spend a lot of our time with these two men on the far left.
Don't pay attention.
Yeah.
I keep on thinking of many are called but few are chosen, isn't that?
Yes.
Because they're, in a way, the hand is really facing into the whole table, and anybody could be hearing that or seeing that invitation at all. Many are called but few. Only Matthew's the one who says, maybe you're addressing me.
Yeah, that's right. He says, who, me? Or again, you know, my hard look at life. Peter, the church, my sense of it kind of going, who, him? It seems sometimes that often the church spends more time questioning people's calls than affirming them.
Yeah, right.
Picking out the negatives.
Picking out the, who, him?
Yeah.
You know, and you know, does he have the right credentials? This, that, and the other. And you know, we do a great job of, you know, at least within the Lutheran tradition, talking about the priesthood of all believers and Luther's notion of vocation, of call, and everyone is there. And that really our baptism is our ordination. Because all of us are ordained, are called for ministry and service to the world. And then what we call ordination in terms of pastors, to say we are, pastors are the ones set apart, ordained or called for specific ministries in the church itself. But that in no way, shape, or form undercuts all of our ministries. And so the question there again is, how does the church affirm the callings of the people of God and not just simply question them? For me, that's one of the key messages that comes through in this painting.
The sense of God's call to Matthew and also to us does allow the question to be asked.
Yes.
Who, me?
Yeah.
You know, the one called. So that's a good sign. I think it's a good sign for me, anyway.
I think the painting also says that when you're called, it doesn't just affect you, the called. Because I think that young man who's leaning on his father, as you said, there's an intimate relationship there. And if Matthew is called, that young man's going to be affected.
Yes. Right.
All right, let's move on. This is a quotation from Abraham Joshua Heschel, and if someone would like to just read that, please. Outlaw, go ahead, anybody.
The prophets had no theory or idea of God. To the prophets, God was overwhelmingly real and shatteringly present. They lived as witnesses struck by the words of God rather than as explorers engaged in effort to ascertain the nature of God. Their utterances were the unloading of a burden rather than glimpses obtained in the fog of broken.
That's for me a profound, profound statement, precisely because that sense of call, prophet is what? A witness struck by the words of God, not trying to figure out who God is, but witnessing to what God is and who God is.
And again, I think that is something important for all of us and our sense of calling. Next, please. This is from Elie Wiesel, A Hasidic Tale. And again, it's that sense of calling as telling the story. When the great rabbi Israel Baal Shem Tov saw misfortune threatening the Jews, it was his custom to go into a certain part of the forest to meditate. There he would light a fire, say a special prayer, and the miracle would be accomplished and the misfortune averted. Later, when his disciple, the celebrated Magid of Metzarich, had occasion for the same reason to intercede with heaven, he would go to the same place in the forest and say, "Master of the universe, listen. I do not know how to light the fire, but I am still able to say the prayer." And again, the miracle would be accomplished. Still later, Rabbi Moshe Leib of Sassof, in order to save his people once more, would go into the forest and say, "I do not know how to light the fire. I do not know the prayer. But I know the place, and this must be sufficient." It was sufficient, and the miracle was accomplished. Then it fell to Rabbi Israel of Rezin to overcome misfortune. Sitting in his armchair, his head in his hands, he spoke to God. "I am unable to light the fire, and I do not know the prayer. I cannot even find the place in the forest. All I can do is to tell the story, and this must be sufficient." And it was sufficient. Enough said, right? Next, please.
Well, the question, the question is, we have this wonderful arc between the Passover, say, and Dinan, who would be more than enough. And then Kierkegaard, who says it would be more than enough to know that the divine had entered history. And so then the question from this is, what is enough? Okay, he keeps narrowing down the possibilities or the sort of sufficient ingredients. And then what would be the next paragraph? Just throw that out.
Okay, great. Anyone want to take up the challenge? What would be the next paragraph?
Or if you forget the story, there is no next paragraph.
And God acted.
Mm. Or perhaps then it fell to the people of Rishen to overcome their misfortunes. And sitting together, their heads in their hands, they spoke to God. We do not know where the fire is or the prayer. We have no rabbi. Can't even find the forest. We can tell the story. We've forgotten the story, but we know you are there. This must be sufficient. Excuse me, another paragraph.
New painting, postmodern. This is a painting by Jack Beale. Date is 1977. You can kind of see the mid-70s dress there, I guess. The name of this painting is called Faith, Hope, and Charity. So the first question I'd like to ask you is, in this painting, who is faith, who is hope, and who is charity?
The dog's faith.
It's not the dog.
this woman on the looks like.
All right, we'll go this way. Who do you want to call this?
Charity.
Charity. Charity.
Hope.
Faith.
No, hope.
Dissension.
Oh, that's faith.
So we'll just have majority vote, and that's who it will be, right? What?
How many think the man is faith? No one. Couple. Three,
yeah,
four.
He's looking.
Yeah, I think he's
looking to the future.
Yeah.
Looking
at. I thought he was reading a book.
He's reading
the. The man is reading the book. Right? If you follow his glance, he's in the book.
Uh-huh.
What might that tell you? Kind of.
The promises. I think he's hope.
You think the man is hope?
Yeah.
He's trying to explain to her. She's saying the truth, so he's trying to explain it to her.
She looks hopeful. Something. I think she looked hopefully at
she does.
She looks hopeful. So that means she must be hope.
So that means
she looks like Caritas. And she looks like charity and love.
This woman?
Yeah.
But it seemed like we were in agreement that this was charity.
Well, I wasn't.
Oh.
She's holding
something stuffed to this.
She's what?
Yeah, she's doing something. She's
giving. Oh, that's
better. Yeah, she has a coin in her hand and she's to be giving it. Where is the...
She's looking to the future. She's looking out.
She's looking out, not necessarily to the future,
okay,
but she's looking out. Just like, in other words, the dog and charity are looking toward us.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Looking out as though, right, and as we're looking in. The man is faith. And the other woman is hope. Now, why is that? Part of the understandings of this, and again, well, is that the man is faith because his focus, you see, is in the book. Both that book that is open, and you can see he has a book in front of him. And so this man of faith, it focused in the book, or to be a bit more broad about it, focused in the word.
It looks like an ancient Bible with illustrations.
It could be, yeah. It's not clear exactly what the book is, but it certainly seems, and I think this is what Beale is trying to get us to think about, and when you do, we understand that indeed faith is rooted, grounded in the word. The word proclaimed. Again, we don't have to talk about it as simply in a book, but rooted in that word. Let's take a look at hope. Who or what is hope looking at?
Faith.
Faith.
No, beyond faith.
Looking at charity.
It's kind of both, isn't it? I mean, I think as you look at her gaze, it's a sense that on the one hand, yes, she's looking at faith, but faith does not totally, fully, completely absorb her gaze. Because if all you do is look at faith, then it's not hope. Right? It's beyond that. There's also the sense, I think, about what is she holding in her hand?
A rose.
And what do roses symbolize?
Hope.
Love.
And what else, all you romantics?
Beauty.
And usually, if you want a rose, when do you first cut it?
When it's a bud,
so that it will what?
Open.
Flower, bloom. And that's always a hopeful kind of thing, isn't it? And so there's that sense there, I think, that the flower is the indicator. Why this is hope.
Her body language, too, the way her angle of her leg is pushing her forward.
Right.
She hopes to get him.
She's the one leaning forward. And then, of course, charity, where is her gaze? And where is all of her tension diverted?
Out. Her tension is out, not inside her.
Which is precisely what charity is always out from ourselves. So that in this sense, if you will, who we are as humans, who we are called to be, in terms of faith, hope, and charity is really tridimensional. Right? We have all three of these characters, if you will, living within us. That our focus is grounded in the Word, and our hope is attached to that Word, and yet beyond, as we spring into the future, as we hope that whatever it is will fully flower, come forth. And our charity, our love, is always directed outward, in fact, if you will, beyond the framework. Always out.
Is this the reading that the artist also intended?
Could be. Hope, faith, charity.
And why do you call it a postmodernist painting?
That was the artist's own characterization. He says it's postmodern.
I'm wondering, do you think that's through hindsight? Because I'm just sort of surprised.
The shadows are all weird.
I can answer that. In our terms, modernist period ended in like late 20s, 30s. So it's just a definition in art history of being postmodern because it was painted at that time period. That helps.
Well, I think the modernist period extended beyond the 20s and 30s.
Yeah. Well, abstract expressionism, this is American artist, kind of came forward in the 40s. As a definition, that's just my understanding of why
he calls himself and what he does postmodern. So,
and like he's got light in this picture, like he had in the other picture too. Isn't there light kind of seem like there's a light surrounding these people?
The fact that the shadows mix and the light mixes, and we could all argue all day on who's who, has something to do with the nature of faith, hope, and charity, and their overlap, and their one is integral to the other and dependent on the other.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that there are hands all over her shirt, which it. How do we do charity? Give with our hands, money, action.
All right, let's move on because our time is very short. The last painting here is by, again, American artist Siegfried Reinhardt, and it is simply called Light. And what we have in it, and again, this I think folks would say is postmodern because it breaks again the normal rules of painting in terms of almost trying to provide this three-dimensional status. You have here the resurrected Christ. Behind him, you can see in the background, the crucified Christ. And then you have here, on the different planes, you have this woman who seems to be in some kind of meditative trance, or so on and so forth. And then again, totally looking away from everything else that's going on, the saxophone player.
New.
From what we see. And so here again, where is the call?
Well, you better figure it out.
Well, no, Christ is calling. How is Christ calling in this picture, in this painting? And it's the resurrected, I'll give you a hint, it's the resurrected Christ who is calling. How is he calling? How is he trying to get our attention?
A whack upside the head?
Well, not quite.
What does he have in his hand?
Yeah, what's in his hand up there?
Crown.
His crown of thorns, but now this crown of thorns is used like a what?
Tambourine.
Wow. He's shaking his crown of thorns like a tambourine.
Against the devil?
No, he's trying to get our attention. He's shaking those thorns to call us. And
nobody's looking at
him. We don't want to hear it.
What's
this woman?
She's
totally self-absorbed, isn't she?
Yeah.
She's self-absorbed.
And what about this guy? He's
making his own music.
He's making his own music. He has no time for the old Crown of Thorns tambourine. He's totally, if you will, I would say, self-indulgent in his own music and his own way. And, you know, behind all of that, right, in the background, is the cross. It's called light. Just quickly, the bell is right. It's called light, I think, because again, we see how the resurrected Christ and the call sheds light on all of this. In other words, whether we respond or don't respond, the call of Christ still illuminates who we are. And that's the quick 3-minute presentation. But lots more.